Everybody was kung fu fighting. Those kids were fast as lightning. In fact, it was a little bit frightening.
On this Halloween night, it's hard. And it's a target. Is it Jean-Claude's abs? No! Is it Mitch Moody's beer belly? No! Is it Evan Moody's groin after a night at a jiggle joint? No! It's Nothing Worthwhile Presents Van Damme It, a podcast about Jean-Claude Van Damme. On today's show, we will span the universe for the latest news on our favorite 80s action stars. If that isn't enough, we will return back to our guy, Jean-Claude Van Damme, as Gru and I will reminisce on 1993's Hard Target, directed by one John.
Woo!
Let's bring him in, our resident Van Dammeologist, making his home in Coconut Creek, Florida. Andrew Gruthius, happy Halloween to you, my friend, and how the hell are you?
To you as well. I'm very well, thank you. In this evening, it is 9:35 here in Coconut Creek, an unusual time for us to be broadcasting, but nonetheless, always a true pleasure. All is well here. It is a Monday, which, as you know, means...
What does it mean?
I don't know.
All the momentum right out the window. I give him a great talk up. He's got some jokes.
Monday is Monday. Monday is Monday.
Yeah,
That's all I got for you.
Do you have trouble getting out of bed on Mondays? Like, I have a slight bit more anxiety.
I have trouble getting into bed. I have trouble doing everything. But yes, Mondays are very difficult. Every day is very difficult, but I think that's where we are. Some things we just accept.
Okay, well, hopefully, Andrew, talking about Jean-Claude and 1993 Hard Target will ease that anxiety.
I hope so.
Make all the blues melt away.
I certainly hope so.
All right, well, you know what, Andrew and I, we talked briefly. Hard Target is certainly a fascinating... At least for us anyway, a fascinating movie to discuss. So today we're going to get right into it. We'll span the universe a bit later on this podcast. Gru, Hard Target, 1993. American action film directed by Hong Kong film director John Woo in his U.S. debut. The film stars Jean-Claude Van Damme, Yancy Butler, Lance Hendrickson, and Arnold Vosloo. Ruthless businessman hunting homeless men. Fascinating topic. Hard Target is based on Richard Connell's 1924 short story, The Most Dangerous Game. And Andrew, before we get into it, as always, today's Van Damme It podcast, Hard Target, is brought to you by New Life Center. Still discussing summer specials, making you fall fabulous. Follow New Life Center on Instagram at New Life Center to take advantage of their specials and monthly giveaways. Check out all of their programs at www.newlifecenters.com or give them a call, 602-274-0068. Tell them Moody and Gru sent you and receive a big 15% off your first service. New Life Center, Phoenix Premier Med Spa for Botox, fillers, lasers, aesthetics, weight loss, and hormone optimization. A big Van Damme It thank you to New Life Center. Gru, going into this podcast, have you not seen Hard Target? Did you see it?
I'd never seen it. But you just threw me a curve because I am very familiar with that story and Most Dangerous Game, and I just realized I knew this movie was familiar when I saw it. Saturday. I had never seen it before. I was only familiar with it as the one with the mullet, and supposedly among fans, one of the more, respected, Van Damme movies. That's all I really knew about it. I had no idea the plot, and I actually, purposely didn't look up anything. I wanted to know nothing about it. going in, and that's the way I went in. So yeah, so no prior knowledge about this.
All right, well then, Gru, you probably will have not hopefully heard any of these things, but a couple of fun facts on 1993's Hard Target. I'll spit them out, and if you have any thoughts about it. And I did hear this one time, I think, on a movie podcast, or maybe perhaps a radio show. Universal was afraid that John Woo's limited English would be a problem on the set, so they hired Sam Raimi to oversee the entire shoot and replace Wu if need be.
Hmm. Is that true?
That is true. Sam Raimi, who we just broke down Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness.
They got Sam Raimi on the bench?
Yes.
That's wow. All right, that sort of changes my outlook a little bit. Let's see. I mean, 1993. So this is like, all right. So this is the Sam Raimi that's like between like Evil Dead and Spider-Man. Spider-Man's still like a decade away.
Yes, that's for sure.
So he's not really back in the mainstream yet. So maybe it's not that big of a deal. But I know John Woo was on his way.
Yeah, well, this is his U.S. debut. I mean, when you heard about it, when you first watched the movie, was that the first time you realized this was John Woo's U.S.
Yes.
debut? Or
not when I only know it's his debut from you telling me. I did not know it was a John Woo movie until it said a John Woo film. So you know that piqued my interest. He went on to like Face Off, right? With Travolta and Nicolas Cage.
Yeah, I think Mission Impossible 2 and Face Off to me first come to mind. I do have a little section on Mr. Wu that we'll hit up.
I didn't know that he had anything to do with it. Didn't know anything about the cast, knew literally nothing.
Speaking of John Woo, the original John Woo's original cut of the film ran nearly 2 hours and focused more on Fu-chan. Jean-Claude Van Damme and his editors locked themselves in an editing room for 2 days and re-edited the film for producers. Van Damme stated that moviegoers were paying to see a Jean-Claude Van Damme movie, not a Lance Henriksen movie. What do you think about that?
Well, it's hard for me to say anything about that without giving away my thoughts about the movie. I will say this, that there are cases to be made on both sides of that coin. Now, could this movie have used another half an hour? The answer is probably not. I think the running time is exactly what it should be. That being said, Lance Henriksen is, at that time, was a big get for a movie like this. So, you know, like I said, there are cases to be made, and when I give you my thoughts on the movie, you know, I'll tell you what I think of that idea.
All right, good. So he gave us a good tease. He didn't, because Andy will give his whole review right now, and then, you know, we're done after 20 minutes. I think
I'm growing.
I think what Andy's saying is there's good people on both sides.
Yes, there's good.
That's a joke,
Jesus
everybody.
Christ.
It does. Well, I did watch one YouTube video on Hard Target, and the guy talked about Jean-Claude being a bit of a diva on the set here, and now, you know, this is like perhaps, again, I don't know if I'm hitting the numbers correctly, you know, his seventh, maybe his eighth movie. I'm not saying all majors. I'm feeling like he's getting into sort of the sweet spot. Like, you know, when you're a pro athlete, you're 28, 29, sort of. He's had a couple of movies under his belt. And,
well,
when I read this and I heard that perhaps Jean-Claude was a bit of a diva on the set, it kind of didn't surprise me.
Didn't surprise me at all, before watching the movie and during the watching the movie. This is not a cheapie. This is, I think it's Universal, if I'm not mistaken. It's a big studio movie. I'll take a gander at the budget later. But there's they obviously spent a couple of bucks. It's not canon. You know, it's not on that level. It's definitely up there, especially, casting wise. At least for the most part. Look, the greatest phrase in movie history is, and Wilford Brimley as Grandpa or Uncle, whatever, you know.
Duvet.
So, you know, you got Wilford Brimley, man, one of the great character actors of all time.
That is true.
So, you know, this was not a small thing. He was a big deal. And I remember when this was out, and I remember it was a moderate hit. And he was making, you know, Van Damme was one of the big guys back then.
Yeah.
That was when Stallone and Schwarzenegger were kind of on the, more Stallone than Schwarzenegger, but, were kind of on the, they were, their stock was dropping, around that time.
You're speaking about Uncle Doovie. It looked like clearly Wilford had not had his oatmeal in quite a while. He looked a little rough
and
around the edges.
His diabetes was acting up.
Yeah. Kurt Russell was originally sought for the role as of Chance Boudreau, but they could not wait 2 years. I guess Kurt had a commitment, and they went with Jean-Claude, who met with John Woo when he was filming Double Impact in Hong Kong. So, Double Impact. That's one we got to cover too. We'll skip around. But what do you think about Kurt? I could see Kurt Russell as Chance Boudreau.
Well, again,
with the hair.
All right,
the hair.
Okay, I got to tease it again because if we're doing casting what ifs, the answer is absolutely. But you could say that for Kurt Russell. You could say that about anything. I mean, he can do. He's an everyman. He can do everything. But I will say, thank God that he did not do this movie. Not that it has anything to do with this movie, except I think the timing works out. I think around this time is when Tombstone came out, and that was to me that's Kurt Russell's opus. So I'm glad that he did that one, but. Insert Kurt Russell in anything like this, and you've got some form of greatness. Kurt Russell is going to go down as one of the true greats.
Well, that summer, many critics called Hard Target, quote, the most violent film of the summer. Noted film critic Kevin Thomas, who enjoyed the picture, said the film's violence was no more explicit than the previous big hit of the fall, Under Siege. What'd you think about the violence in Hard Target? I felt like it definitely was, though, a bit of a step up.
Yes, I disagree with the comparison. The violence in this is much more graphic. In Under Siege and in those early Seagal movies in general, it was much more stylized, I think. And less graphic, more like bone crunching. Here you had a little of that, but they went for some blood here. They did some pretty interesting things, sometimes did and sometimes didn't feel exactly necessary. But yeah, this movie was definitely upped the violence. Without a doubt. And that was something that took me by surprise when I was watching.
Well, yeah, speaking of violence, the ear-cutting scene.
Oh, yeah.
With that fat bastard was included
the poor
by
guy.
Director.
For whatever reason, I always sympathize with those kind of guys.
Yeah, I love the two suitcases running for, you know, to the car. You knew he was toast right then and there.
It's all special effects because guys like that do not run. We do not run. All right. So, I mean, we might race walk, but we're not running.
Well, the ear cutting scene was included by, director John Woo as a friendly homage to Reservoir Dogs, which was, 1992. Which included the trademark Woo Mexican standoff. I think the Mexican standoff is a bunch of good guys and bad guys on either side with guns and just,
yeah,
you know, guns, bullets flying, debris splashing all over.
Yeah,
know.
And that was the ending of Reservoir Dogs.
Feathers, you know, feathers. Yeah, yeah, right.
Yeah.
Actually, the crew had
the ending of Face. It was the ending of Face Off too, from what I remember. That was a big schmoz.
Yes. The crew had to construct a bulletproof shield to protect the camera, which was named the Woo Woo Choo Choo. Woo Woo Choo Choo. All right, let's move on. Hard Target originally earned an NC-17 rating for violence. It was resubmitted to the Motion Picture Association 7 times before it finally earned an R rating. What do you think about that?
I mean, it's definitely a hard R, but I've seen, like, this movie is, well, let me ask you, would you compare this, I would say Die Hard is more violent than this. Oh, come on, they blow that guy's head off in Die Hard.
The only time I ever got like a slight squeamish, and it wasn't really overtly violent, was when McClane walks on the floor with the glass and realizes his feet are all sharded up, and you get a pretty graphic shot of his feet with the glass.
Yeah, this one had me. Yeah.
I can't say I shrieked at the violence here for Hard Target, no. But. I definitely felt it was a step up for sure.
Yeah, but NC-17. I mean, Showgirls wasn't that violent.
I was about to say maybe Nancy showed it breast, or I don't know. I don't. We got
now, maybe that's the extra half hour that they cut out. I don't know, but and I expected that, you know. Well, all right, we'll wait for opinions.
Well, Gru, you've been on a set. I don't know if this is overtly interesting, but production lasted 74 days for Hard Target. However, the film was put on a tight schedule by Universal that allowed only 65 days of shooting time. This put a lot of pressure on John Woo. He was also pressured by Universal to tone down the violence and body count that they had seen in his Hong Kong film. So, Andrew, you've definitely been on sets. Any thoughts on scheduling, whether the director goes over, and have you seen instances where companies or outside forces, you know, pressure the director to take it one way or another?
Yeah, picture. For an analogy, you know, you're in the education business, and you know, you're in charge of program, you know, curriculum. You know what the children should be learning. You've been in the classroom. You've done all the research. Okay, you know. So you bring it to, you bring what you need to the higher ups, and they say, okay, well, we can only do about 40% of that because this is the budget that we have. And you're like, we can't educate our children on this budget. There is no physical way to do anything productive with the amount of money that you are providing. So you're going to go and do the absolute best you can. And yeah, you're going to spend money that is not there. That's necessary. You know, educators have to do it all the time, reaching into their pockets, to make their jobs either easier or more accessible, and providing what they believe is the right kind of education to kids. Movie directors do the same thing in most cases when they're not part of the production team, meaning producers, meaning the investors. So the director has a vision. The director knows what he wants. The director doesn't think about price. He just says, I need a volcano right over there. And he doesn't care what it costs. He needs something that's going to look, sound, smell, and feel like a volcano in order to make his movie work. And directors and producers are constantly clashing over that, over the director wanting to make his personal best possible movie as opposed to the producers wanting to make the best possible movie for him to sell. And that's and so they will always clash on that. And definitely a guy like John Woo, who brings his own brand of movie making to America for the first time, is definitely going to have to clash with people who are spending the money. Sorry, long answer to a short question.
Andrew Guthius, thank NBC you. News.
One to grow, huh?
Take it from Andrew, like, you go, yeah. Hey, well, give us an example on a movie set. He's like, a heart-wrenching, like, you know, an education. I had it like a tissue. I was like, that happened to me. That happened to me last Tuesday. Yeah, I could just see, like, John Woo, like, screaming in Japanese and Sam Raimi translating. He wants a volcano over there.
Yeah.
Effort and make it happen.
Yeah, I mean, you know what you need. You know what you need to do the job that you want to do. You don't want – it's your name. It's John Woo. It's going to be a John Woo film. That means that his name is attached to it, so directors feel that they have the right to make it however they feel it needs to be made. And to most extent, they're right. It's the producers that hire them for their reputation, for the kind of movies that they make. And guess what? You get, you know, you, if you were gonna, if you want it, you gotta pay for it. So that's, you know, so these directors, the good ones, like a John Woo or Quentin Tarantino, these guys, you give them what they say they need. That's a lesson that I learned, out there. You give the pros, if the pro says that they need it, you give it to them.
Okay. You're talking about John Woo. Chuck Farr, I think, wrote the screenplay, or he was in a producer. He had the story take place in New Orleans to give an explanation for Jean-Claude Van Damme's accent. I love crap like that. I love shit like that.
Are you kidding me?
How's the gumbo, Chance? Oh, it's so crappy. Here's 20 cents.
Wait, let me finish my... All right, go ahead. Yeah.
Fortunately, director John Woo loved the setting of New Orleans, as he wanted to make the movie look like a Western. This group was John Woo's English language directorial debut. This also marked the first big Hollywood studio movie to be helmed by an Asian director. I mean, come on, I was not the least surprised that they had it in New Orleans to kind of give clearance to Jean-Claude's, you know, still pretty strong accent.
I was trying to intercut in, are you telling me that his accent is supposed to be a New Orleans accent?
Listen, I mean,
from the get-go, you know exactly, that's some of my commentary about the movie, that it goes out of its way to try in a Scorsese type way to use the setting as kind of a character. You know what I mean?
I can agree. Yeah, so I don't know about Scorsese,
the way that he does, this movie tries to do, and I get it and I see it. It just, the genre doesn't, to me, the kind of movie this is doesn't really call for it, unless there's one big thing that makes it sink or swim that, you know, I don't want to reveal yet.
Yeah. I'm interested to hear. Yeah. Hold it for the final. Yeah. The character Van Cleef was named after actor Lee Van Cleef. He played a sadistic antagonist in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. I think it was one of those spaghetti westerns.
Yeah.
okay, so we talked about Van Damme. So I guess my final item in terms of this segment was one of the difficulties for director John Woo was dealing with the star power of Jean-Claude Van Damme, who exerted a lot of control over the project from script approval to filming to final cut. This I have heard even prior to the movie, to this podcast. Van Damme would insist on having one of the cameras focused on his muscles at all times. Wu complied, but never used any of the footage. Van Damme would also delay filming because he was often on a phone negotiating new projects. I heard that as well. Despite the difficulty, Wu did not regret working with Jean-Claude, calling him a, quote, quite interesting guy, and actually preferred the experience of filming in the United States over working in Asia for some years to come. We did talk a little bit about Jean-Claude, but we get it right from the mouth of the director. Jean-Claude Van Damme, comma, diva.
Yeah, makes exact sense. And if you look at the movie, you know, you said you'd heard that stuff. I didn't know anything about this movie, so none of that surprises me. Look at it. I mean, the dude looks like a supermodel, and we're supposed to buy that he's homeless. You know, it's just, so you can see, you know, you just said, I mean, there's a shot late in the movie where he finally takes the big overcoat off.
Yes.
And he's running in slow motion. And you know, you said that right there. I'm like, well, yeah, there it is right there. It's like,
yes, I agree.
You know, so I can totally see that. And that's, you know what? That was a sign of the times. Stallone was like that. Stallone, you know, you read about Stallone, you know, doing, you know, like the third Rambo or those kind of movies. Like there was a lot of vanity there. So these guys were like that. I don't dispute that. I don't doubt that at all. Makes perfect sense. Van Damme was hot at the time. As far as box office.
You mean as an actor or just as like his body and his shape?
Oh, both. Look at him.
Oh, okay.
Christ's sake. I mean, Jesus Christ. You know, we can say that, but I mean, you know, the truth is the truth. The dude's a fucking Adonis. It's annoying.
I don't know how to feel about that, folks. But,
you know exactly. You know exactly how to feel about that.
You know damn well. Gru, Hard Target's runtime is 1 hour, 37 minutes. Gru, let's take a look at the cast. We've already mentioned a couple of people. Of course, there's Jean-Claude Van Damme as Chance Boudreau. Yancey Butler as Natasha Nat Binder.
Yeah, I don't understand. Can you explain something to me? That name, you know, when she came on the screen, she did not look familiar, but the name, she sounds a lot more famous than she seems to be. Does that make sense to you? I looked her up. I haven't seen her in anything.
So did I.
But I've heard that name over and over again over the years.
I've definitely seen other projects with Yancey Butler. It looked like she had a nice run, but a lot of TV work and some supportive stuff.
Right.
But if we talk about sweet spot, I mean, I thought she was quite beautiful.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
But, you're right.
She's gorgeous.
It almost feels like this might be the high point. Again, I don't have her entire filmography in front of me. Because when I looked at, like, Lance Hendrickson and Arnold Vosloo, who, you know, had some big runs, I looked at Yancey and I was like, I don't know if there's enough there to kind of comment a little bit further with Gru. Of course, we have Lance Hendrickson as Emile Fuchan, Chuck Pafara as Douglas Binder, Arnold Vosloo as Pick Van Cleef. That was a fun role to watch. Willie Carpenter as Elijah Roper and Cassie Lemons as Detective Marie Mitchell. Gru, we talked a little bit about Lance Hendrickson, born May 5th, 1940. He's really known as a lot of his work in a lot of movies, science fiction, action, horror. Gru. He was in some television series as well, Millennium, X-Files. Let me read just a couple of these movies because I'm not saying they're major, major roles in all these films, but quite the filmography. Dog Day Afternoon, Network. Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Alien.
The Terminator,
right?
The Terminator. Jagged Edge. Aliens. On Dangerous Ground, Alien 3, Super Mario Brothers, Hard Target, The Quick and the Dead, Powder, Tarzan, Scream 3, Alien vs. Predator, When a Stranger Calls, Jennifer's Body, grew quite the career for Lance Henriksen.
Hell yeah. Well, he's one of those great, like, second banana kind of, you know, in the top tier movies, he's a second banana. In the lower tier movies, he's a top guy, like this one.
Yes.
What was that last movie you said?
Jennifer's Body?
No. Before that.
When a Stranger Calls?
The last couple.
Aliens vs. Predator?
Yes, he was in that?
Yes,
I didn't see it. He was in that?
Yeah, they try to connect Aliens vs. Predator, which is the much better, in my eyes, Andy liked Requiem, but I liked AVP better because he plays Charles Weyland, and there's the connection that Bishop was a Weyland-Yutani android.
Oh,
so the androids were built out of his likeness.
Wow. All right. Yeah. Lance Henriksen is a big get. And his performance is terrific. He really is good. I really enjoyed, he chews the scenery a lot, which is what the villain has to do in a movie like this. And he's really good at it. And I think that I would say, as far as like, is this his only main villain role that he's had? Has he had a role that he was like the main bad guy or one of the main leads in, you know, he's usually lower?
That's a good question.
I know he had an interesting role. He was like the hero cop in a horror movie about a guy who he was a cop. He put him away and he was electrocuted.
Oh, Shocker?
No, it was the other one. It was the same story, the horror show it was called, where the guy, you know, comes back to life.
Yeah.
But Henriksen is still around, isn't he?
Yeah, I think he's getting a bit older. It looks like after like 2009, it kind of the filmography slows down. I think he's done some voice acting work on animation. Gru, any familiarity with Arnold Vaslo?
No, you're telling me that you are. He was really good. I really enjoyed him. He and Lance Henriksen make a really good tandem here. I really enjoyed, but he did not seem familiar to me.
Yeah, I knew him from, he's, Imhotep from the first, I think, two Mummy films. Brandon Fraser, he plays,
I didn't see those ones.
I think at the time they were kind of like straight to cable, but he did Darkman 2 and Darkman 3. I think he took over for Liam Neeson. He took, you know, the Darkman movies, which were very interesting, very creative.
I only saw the first one, so.
Yeah, he was in Blood Diamond, G.I. Joe, The Rise of the Cobra.
Hmm.
He was in the TV series Bones, and he was on the fourth season of 24.
He was really good in this. I really enjoyed his physical mannerisms. He had some really cool moves with the, he did something with the gun or with the, something, he did a good job. I liked him in this.
Yeah, he did. I thought the signature shot with Wu, who we'll talk about real quick, was, him and Jean-Claude were back to back loading the guns, but by that thin wall, you know, that was a cool shot. All right, Gru, of course, any review of Hard Target would not be complete without acknowledging its director, John Woo. John Woo was a Hong Kong filmmaker known to be an influential figure in the action film genre. He was a pioneer, I guess, in Hong Kong for heroic bloodshed films, gun-fu genre in Hong Kong action cinema before working in Hollywood films. He is known for highly chaotic action sequences, stylized imagery, Mexican standoffs, Frequent use of slow-mo. You get all that here in a Hard Target. Mm-hmm. Allusions to film noir and Western cinema. Actually, as I'm standing here, I'm looking out my window and I see three doves passing the window. I didn't know too much about John Woo. Hard Boiled, I've heard of. That's a big Hong Kong action movie. Hard Target, Broken Arrow, 1996, Face Off, 1997, and Mission Impossible, 2000. But, you know, John Woo was a pretty big name in the 90s and early 2000s. Gru, any additional thoughts on Mr. Woo?
Yeah, I mean, you know, he had a good eye for action. Those movies you described after this, you know, Broken Arrow, I really enjoyed. His movies, if you look at them, they're very slick. They all look good. They all, you know, there's not much grit to them. Very stylized, which I think hurts this movie a little bit. And I'll talk about that in a second. But, Face Off, I remember enjoying a lot.
So did I.
Broken
so
Arrow
did I.
As well. I know Mission Impossible. I've never seen Mission Impossible. I've never seen any of them, and I've heard nothing but great things about all of them. So, is he still around? Is he still doing stuff?
I didn't really clip the whole thing on John Woo. I do think, the Hard Target, the Jean-Claude standing on the motorcycle, I think was later recycled for MI2. I've always felt like Mission Impossible, the first one with John Voight, was a little bit more espionage and a little bit slower and more thought out. And then I always think like Woo took Mission Impossible right into that whole action.
Right.
Almost like an Aliens comparison. Maybe it's a little bit broad, but, you know, second one, I remember the commercial and, you know, MTV, and it was just, you know, you could see that it was kind of no pretenses. It was going to be like a straight action, you know, action movie, which I pretty much have kept the franchise, you know, ever since.
Yeah, I'm looking at his filmography, and it's interesting how he, since a movie called, I remember this movie, Paycheck. It's in 2003, and since then it's been like a whole bunch of things I've never even heard of. So that's interesting about him. But hey, look, he had a run of movies that any up and coming, you know, wannabe director would die for. So it is what it is. But yeah, he had some winners.
Gru, let's talk through the plot of Hard Target. We get the opening scene where Douglas Bender, he's a homeless United States Force Recon Marine, Vietnam War veteran. He's running for his life. He has a belt containing $10,000. He's got to reach the other side of town. I think he's got to reach like the ferry. I think
the
wasn't
river.
It like
the river?
The river. Okay. The river. And he's being pursued by Emil Fuchan, his lead right-hand man, Pick Van Cleef, and a businessman named Mr. Lopaki, Fuchan's client, who pays $500,000 for an opportunity to hunt a human. And, of course, Bender fails to reach his destination. He's killed by three crossbow bolts, and Van Cleef retrieves the money belt. We see later on Bender's estranged daughter, Natasha. She is in New Orleans searching for her father. She's attacked by a group of muggers, and she's saved by a homeless man with exceptional martial arts skill named Chance Bujo, former Marine himself. Bujo's initially hesitant to involve himself in her mission to find her dad, but his union dues are in arrears. I guess he's like an offshoreman, like he goes on a boat and he can't get on the boat because he hasn't paid off his dues. All right, so we'll take a little break.
$217.
What'd you think of the early setup of the film?
Well, right away, immediately, okay?
Go ahead.
They are hitting you in the face with the New Orleans thing. And like they're taking great pains to show that we're in New Orleans, that New Orleans is going to factor into whatever else is happening around here. The premise, the setup is excellent. And I remember because the Most Dangerous Game, I remember being a fascinating short story to me when I was in high school. And there are so many different variations. And I remember, when I was watching this the other day, like trying to remember where I knew this from. These rich, tycoons, they pay this guy to, hunt down, you know, killing is supposed to be a rush in this, you know, in this thing. So that premise is really promising. And unfortunately, it all falls apart. Well, see, it's a good setup. It's a good setup.
I love when this podcast goes right off the rails.
It's a good setup. Interesting setup. Until they start painting by the numbers, which is pretty much after the opening credits.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Yeah. No. They introduced the long lost daughter. Now it's like, okay. It's like cliches abound. You got the one guy who knows more than anybody else for whatever reason.
You mean the CD recruiter Poe?
No, not Poe.
Randall Poe.
Not Poe. Who's the their token black guy? Who of course gets killed.
Elijah. Well,
yeah.
I mean, do we want to end the podcast?
No.
I say to him, he's like Chris Farley. Like, I save it for the end. And he's like,
okay.
Great opening scene. I hated the film.
All right. Let me ask you a question. I'm not saying I hated it. I'm criticizing it as we go. So it's a good setup, cause we got as far as what? What's the last thing you said?
Well, we see the daughter. She gets, of course, confronted by bad guys.
So when the setup is excellent, once it gets into its formula, its plot is a little too formulaic for me so far. So I was a little let down going into that. However, now I was so here's how I felt. Opening. When I saw John Woo, when I saw the quality of the talent involved and the story, the setup, I was like, this is going to be a super above average, more than, you know, a better than average Van Damme movie. I was like really excited about that. Then when we dropped into the formulaic plot, I was like, okay, it's going to be not much different than the other ones we've seen. And that might be fine. That might not be fine. We've seen good ones. We've seen bad ones. So that's how I felt at this point.
Yeah, like Gru was like, as I was, like really excited for the start of the movie. Then 20 minutes in, he was like, oh, I wonder if, oh, look, spoilers for Raw. no DQ.com on his phone. He's like, all right, well, I'm going to try to save my overall thoughts, but I understand where Andy is going.
Well, I didn't say that I didn't like it yet. I just said it started out differently, and I was a little let down early on because it started more promisingly than I had hoped. It started very promisingly, and it sort of sunk into the usual Van Damme stuff, which could be good. We've seen good ones, so we'll find out.
Well, we know that Natasha discovers that her dad distributed flyers for a seedy recruiter named Randall Poe, fat guy with unshaven face, stains on wife beater t-shirt. He had been supplying Fuchan with homeless men with war experience and no family ties. Natasha questions, Nat questions Poe about her father's death, but they are discovered by an eavesdropping Van Cleef. Fuchan and Van Cleef beat Poe and cut his ear as punishment. And then, of course, they get New Orleans police detective Mary Mae Mitchell, of course, because she says if things work awfully slow around here. You hear? Wheels of justice move slow out here in New Orleans. That was a joke. Everything's like, you hear? That's how you do a Cajun. You hear? Yeah. And of course, Chance Boudreau goes on his own investigation. He searches in there was a fire. They claim that the man's body was burned in a fire. He finds his additional dog tag, which was pierced by one of the crossbow bolts. Van Cleef's henchmen subtly ambush Boudreau and beat him unconscious to scare him and Natasha. He recovers. He goes back to Officer Mitchell with the dog tag as evidence that Binder was murdered. With the investigation getting closer, Van Cleef and Fuchan decide to relocate their hunting business and begin to eliminate loose ends. The medical examiner apparently was in the bag with Fuchan and Van Cleef. He's executed along with Poe. Then they recruit Boudreau's friend, Elijah Roper, who we've seen earlier in the movie. He's
Elijah. God damn it. I mean, does it get more stereotypical than that? Seriously.
Yeah. Did you feel that this movie was, that was kind of the least of my criticism. Like the tropiness of it.
It dialed it down a little bit.
I thought if anything, the scene where like they're at the homeless encampment and it's like, I don't know, so all this overwhelming filth and squalor, and yet Elijah looked pretty clean and ready to go. Although I guess they did position him and Chance as like leaders in the homeless community, so to speak.
Yeah, and they just should have named him instead of Elijah. They should have just named him Dead Man Walking because you knew.
Well, the second he
walked on screen and we realized which character in this formula he was going to be,
yeah,
we knew that he was a goner.
We saw disposable. He's next to participate in Fuchan's hunt. Now, they offered him the money. Okay, yeah, he was just really desperate. He wanted the money.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, well, he gets close, but he ends up dead. Mitchell, Natasha, and Boudreau arrive moments later at Randall's car and are ambushed by Van Cleef and several of his men during the shootout. Mitchell, the police officer, she's shot in the chest and dies. Boudreau, with a little pistol, somehow knocks off a handful of mercenaries and escapes with Nat. Fuchan and Van Cleef assemble their mercenary team and five hunters to continue the chase. You had some big set pieces there on the highway and, some pretty, pretty graphic and fairly long shootouts, with the bullets spraying and the glass, spraying everywhere. And, of course, we get the final set piece, Boudreau and Natasha go to in the bayou. You hear? Uncle Clarence Duvet. Yeah. House. Of course he's deep in the bayou. Of course he's wearing overalls and he's making whiskey.
Moonshine.
Yeah, moonshine, right. Even better. And Chance says, Uncle, I need your help. Of course, Uncle's looks like he's a 50-year drunk. He's a pretty handy hunter himself. They lead the guys to a Mardi Gras graveyard. And again, I think that's, if you do take a step back, that's, where John Woo's imagery, like it did kind of give you a pretty weird stylistic kind of final set piece being in like a Mardi Gras warehouse with all these, all these imagery floats, statues. Yeah. They kill off Fuchan's men one by one. Of course, Van Cleef, he's finally gunned down, and that leaves Fuchan and Boudreau. And we have a series of back and forth. And of course, Van Damme, I think, yeah, he puts the grenade down his pants and he tries to dismantle it and, oop, out of time.
Going and right out of Tango and Cash.
And it turns out that Uncle Doovie is still alive as the arrow.
Of course he is. You can't kill Grandpa.
Only hit his liquor flask and, Boudreaux, Nat, and Doovie make their way out of the warehouse. End credits song, the end.
Born on the Bayou.
All right, Gru, I know you're chomping at the bit. You here to give your final review. However, first, in your wheelhouse, you've done a great job. Want to give a gander to the production budget for 1993 Hard Target.
Production budget was, I am going to say, they spent some money. They got some popular songs around the time. $22 million.
My boy's good. I have $19.5 million.
All right. A little off. A little over.
Andrew, do you remember 1993? Take a gander at, I'm going to give you the total box office for Hard Target. What was the total take, domestic, international included?
I'm going to say, I remember this being well received. I remember being a moderate hit, not a blockbuster, but I'm going to say, $75 million.
Seriously, do you look this up?
Not at all. How much? What is it?
I had some Cajun for dinner tonight in preparation for Hard Target.
How much is it?
Over 32 domestic, over 41 international, for a total of $74.2 million.
Really? See, to be fair, I was saying $75 million domestic.
Well, that's fine.
But hey, I'll take the W. Yeah, I thought, all right. I thought it was a bigger domestic hit than it was, but.
I mean, 32, over 32.5, so 33 if you round up.
Yeah, 93 blockbusters were.
That's only $7 million less than, Howard Stern Private Parts, so I mean.
Well,
was that,
you know what? Private Parts was not a hit when, you know, in 97. It was a success. It was not a hit. I even remember what Private Parts grossed in his first weekend. 14 million, which was nice, but not a hit. And in 93, that was after the blockbusters started, like Batman and Terminator 2. So I would say 30 something million is not. Domestic is not a hit. It's
okay.
A moderate success, not a hit.
I think that's fair enough. Hmm. While Andrew is formulating his final review, let's take a look at what some of the critics said about Hard Target. You want to give a guess at the Rotten Tomatoes tomato meter score based on 40 critical reviews?
Yeah, I mean, from what you've said and from what others said, this movie was very well received. Or for a Van Damme movie, so I will say, I'll go right smack in the middle and say 50% and see what comes back.
I had 60%.
Wow, that's surprising. But
Rotten Tomatoes gave Hard Target an audience score of 49% based on over 25,000 audience member reviews.
Wait, are you telling me that the critical thing is higher than the audience thing for a Van Damme movie?
That's what I got, brother.
Wow.
All right, let's give Andrew a couple of quick quotes on Hard Target. Dwayne Burge from The Hollywood Reporter. The combo is an incendiary mix. Wu unleashes all barrels in vintage Hong Kong action style, while Van Damme delivers not only his martial arts prowess, but some well-developed acting skills as well. Kim Newman, Empire Magazine. Though it lacks the epic feel and melodramatic sincerity of Wu's Oriental movies, this is nevertheless first-rate action. Janet Maslin, New York Times, presenting Mr. Van Damme as reverentially as Sergio Leone did the young Clint Eastwood. Mr. Wu displays a real aptitude for malignant mischief, which is this story's stock in trade. Peter Travers from Rolling Stone says, even when the acting is hammy, notably Wilford Brimley's turn as Chance's Cajun uncle, Wu stages every fight with hypnotic grace. And finally, Destin Thompson from the Washington Post, essentially Hard Target is a risk-adverse Van Damme vehicle, steered by many hands and set on tracks leading directly to the delivery entrances of this country's video stores. So I guess Mr. Thompson, not too much a fan. Andrew Griffiths, your time is now. Give us the definitive Van Damme word on Hard Target on a scale of 0 to 4 crossbows. Gru, line up your shot and tell us what we need to know about Hard Target.
All right, so...
Look at him. You got to see the visual. He's like kicking back in his chair. He's got like a pen cap. He's chewing on. He's like, all right, everybody.
All right, here we go. All right.
Yeah. So,
all right. A lot about this movie works. The setting, the story, most of the acting, with two great exceptions. And unfortunately, the two great exceptions in the acting department are what kills the movie. Yancey Butler and Jean-Claude Van Damme are completely out of place in this movie. You put a Kurt Russell in that part, and this movie's a big hit. Because he will bring out the grit that and the style that is needed for what they're trying to do. What you're saying about Van Damme being like a diva kind of and making sure like all these shots and whatever and shifting the focus off of the villain onto him makes perfect sense. That's what sinks the movie, his vanity. Okay, you take that out of it. See, I was picturing other people in this role. Kurt Russell wasn't one of them, but now that you said that, I think he would have been great. I was picturing, like, believe it or not, I was picturing like a Steven Seagal, early 90s, you under siege Steven Seagal, in that. But listen, you're asking me to buy Jean-Claude Van Damme in the state that he's in as a homeless vet. Give me a fucking break. All right. He is an Adonis. He's handsome. He's got more mousse in his hair than in Walgreens. I mean, all right. If you're going to sell all this other stuff, you can't put all this other baggage on the shoulders of a lead it's just in the wrong movie. And Yancey Butler, forget about it. Go ahead. Yeah.
I'm raising my hand.
Go, please.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, buddy. That's so sweet.
Well,
do they do that? Well, Why do they do that, though? Why not ugly him up? He's got a Don Johnson stubble. He's got a J. Crew shirt, like a beautiful blue baby blue.
Sleeves rolled up? What fucking homeless guy has his sleeves rolled up?
It's incredible. Why not at least go there and try to make it believable?
You're 1,000% right, and that, to me, that offsets, you know, what the other parts of the movie are trying to do. Lance Henriksen is almost trying to overcompensate. Well, guess what? If you're gonna have a guy eat the scenery like he does, your lead has to be has to be some kind of foil. There's no chemistry. There's nothing. There's nothing there. Van Damme and Yancey Butler bring nothing.
Really?
No. I wasn't interested in anything. And everything was just so obvious. And they just, even ending the movie with Born on the Bayou by Fogerty, they're trying to be hip, and they're like, I don't know. It's like they're trying to be something. They don't know what kind of movie they want it to be. Do they want it to be a cheesy canon 80s style action movie, or do they want it to be a modern day thriller? Well, they can't have both. And did you notice that evidently nobody lives in New Orleans?
With the shootouts?
No, there's nobody there. There's nobody anywhere. Look at any street. We've been to New Orleans. You've been to New Orleans. There are people all over the fucking place. Yeah. And they're playing the music, and then like boing on the boing.
Well, you do see like in the French Quarter, there are some people on the street, but anytime a big death sequence goes down, the streets are mysteriously bare.
And then
the guy is like not even in a rush to leave. He's almost standing over the body, like in a braggadocious kind of stance, like, you know, all cocky, and you see nothing. So yeah, that is
this could have been so much more than it ended up being. I could imagine that people wanted to do this script because it is a decent story, just very poorly executed. I'm giving it, what is it,
0 to 4 crossbows.
All right, I'm giving it one crossbow.
Wow!
I'm giving it one crossbow because I remember Ryan was saying how he's really excited about this one because he likes it a lot. This is supposed to be Van Damme's Schindler's List or something. I don't know, but
okay. So here's what I would say before we get to my thoughts. So Jean-Claude has been in a handful of movies.
Mm-hmm.
He's not a neophyte. I would say this. I think it's a fair expectation to say this is kind of where he's getting into a sweet spot, where he's been in a bunch of movies, perhaps not overall high quality, but he's been in a bunch of big movies. Do you think there's a bit of regression here? Because that kind of crossed my mind watching this. Like, I came into this with really, real high expectations.
Yeah,
and I was disappointed too. I felt like, I don't know, I just want to see. I felt like there was like...
So you had never seen it either?
I remember seeing it a long, long time ago, and I don't remember much of... Some of it looked familiar, you know, when I watched it again, but I didn't really have any thoughts like I would or I've had on other films. I didn't really have what did young Evan Moody think of it? You know, no, mm-hmm. I couldn't remember.
Yeah, well, I feel the same way. I was let down by what I heard about it and what I saw in the beginning. It's a cool setup, cool location. They just couldn't, what you described about, I have seen before, where you said that Van Damme was the one who went into the editing room and changed some things around.
Or he was in the editing room and demanded, that the film be more of a focus on him.
Yeah, well,
you kind of intimated earlier in the podcast you had some thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, you can see that. Constantly, but as someone who's been involved in that kind of stuff, when there are too many cooks in the kitchen, you get a mishmash, and that's kind of what this is, unfortunately. So, good try, but didn't work for me.
Hold on, so Andy.
What happened?
Hold on. Here we go. Okay. All right. So one crossbow.
Yeah. One crossbow for really striking out hard. Like, am I going to say if you're asking me if it's a better movie than, like a Kickboxer or even a No Retreat, No Surrender, the answer is yes. But you have different expectations from different kinds of movies.
And I agree.
So I expected much, much more from what they had to make this movie. That's why I scored so low.
Well, I'll take it from here, and I can't really disagree much with Andrew. I did like some of the aspects of the John Woo direction. The shot in the sort of a more of a chops hockey style. We got a lot of slow-mos. In this movie, I found that this is just a little funny aside. We actually have a fund the police demonstration.
Yeah.
I was like, whoa, we really know times have changed. You know, I thought there was some decent rapport between Van Damme and Yancey Butler. Lance Hendrickson is typically his great self as the over-the-top villain, almost Nick Cage-ish. I mean, towards the end, yeah. It's just so over-the-top with the
How
yelling.
How many times did he yell, son of a bitch? Like, he kept saying, I mean, son of a bitch, over and over and over again.
You know, some interesting visuals. The underhand gunshot was really cool. Yeah. And I did think this was the most violent of the Van Damme films so far.
Absolutely.
What I didn't like, I'm going to be honest, maybe I'm a wuss, but hunting human beings, uncomfortable premise for me. It's not something that, you know, I was a little uncomfortable even with, you know, a 93 sort of over-the-top action film. You know, Gru, there's something magical about a homeless encampment that tugs on the heartstrings. You know, I thought this movie at some points was a little cruel, and a disheveled Wilford Brimley looking like this is a late paycheck.
Oh, I love that guy.
I'm assuming this was towards the end of maybe Wilford's major movie run, but. I can't really disagree with anything Andrew said. I mean, I was just so stuck on Van Damme as a homeless guy. And I mean, like, he knew everybody in town. They
no
gave
way.
Him a free gumbo.
No way.
Stubble. No effing way, Ganji. No effing way. I told you not to use the and I think here's the other thing, and this may be blasphemy. Looking back on John Woo's first U.S. movie, I agree. It's a better movie, but I wanted to be blown away by the visuals,
yes,
and I wasn't.
There you go.
That's the whole thing. You get a lot of slow-mos that are unnecessary. You know, the three doves, and again, at the time, maybe it was like so cool because he's first opening into the American market, but yeah, I think it's trying to be something that it's not. And
you don't do that. If you want New Orleans, you have to film it like New Orleans, and there's a grit that is
dirty.
Not there.
Yeah.
You gotta be dirty, you gotta feel like sweaty when you're in New Orleans, like, and you don't. You feel like, look how well groomed he is. Nobody's that well groomed.
No crap. I know, right?
Nobody's that well groomed in New Orleans, you know, like, people wearing suits are sweating through the suits. I mean, it's just the type of city that it is. So it just, you just don't buy it. And when you don't buy it, like, it becomes a joke. And this is not the type of movie that works if it's going to be a joke, like a kickboxer or those kind of movies. It's not that.
And it's a shame because I think really the supporting cast, like you said, Lance Hendrickson, really carry most of the good points of the movie. So I gave it just two crossbows, and I was disappointed. And I did feel it was like a dip for Jean-Claude, you know, I don't know, early on, watching those early Van Damme movies, I was actually heartened because I said to myself, and going into this, you know, this podcast, I was the first to admit I was not a major Jean-Claude Van Damme fan.
Those early movies,
he can emote, and he's not a terrible actor, and I still say that here, but yeah, I was really disappointed in Hard Target.
He doesn't even do anything here.
Yeah.
As far as acting. Like, there's no... I mean, I was almost rooting for a romance between the two, even though that would have been completely cliche. Would have given him something interesting to do. Or someone interesting to do. Hey, now.
Yeah, well, they do hint at a romance between Chance and Nat.
I can't believe you just said
that. I mean, and are you really
you sound like
that?
You sound like a teenager, like, chance of that is going out.
Yeah, hard target too, chance in that.
Yeah, there was a hard target too.
Yeah,
I have no idea. I don't know anything about it, but.
Yeah. Well, all right, listen, disappointed. Hopefully better things are ahead for Jean-Claude. Grill, you want to get to our final segment?
Yeah, what's our next Van Damme? Do we know?
Well, don't we say it at the end of the show?
Oh, yeah, okay. Okay, I forgot. What?
All right, let's move on. before we drift out of here, let's check out the latest news on our favorite 80s era action stars. It's time for Van Damme, Spanning the Universe.
Van Damme, Spanning the Universe. Yo!
Rue, Spanning the Universe is brought to you by New Life Center. Begin a new you. Check out all of their medical weight loss programs at www.newlifecenters.com. Give them a call, 602-274-0068. Tell them Moody Grew sent you and receive a big 15% off your first service. New Life Center, we are in this journey together. Groot, have you said you've not seen Jean-Claude in Time Cop? Are you going on record as saying you've never seen Time Cop?
I've never seen Time Cop.
Okay, I don't know what you think about this little ditty, but courtesy of GiantFreakingRobot.com, wow, I'm really digging for items. But
I actually read their stuff.
Yeah.
I do.
Time Cop to some people may be considered Jean-Claude's best movie. We'll debate that sometime later in the podcast. Okay. I am so sorry.
What?
Jean-Claude's best movie becoming a television series as Kickboxer is now being turned into a potential TV series. It appears that a series is being developed based on one of Jean-Claude's best movies, Kickboxer, and the showrunner tapped to lead the series through the development process has ties to the Fast and Furious film franchise. According to a report by Deadline, Jean-Claude Van Damme's Kickboxer franchise will be turned into a new television series entitled Operation Kickboxer, with Gary Scott Thompson of the Fast and the Furious fame leading the show. The original Kickboxer movie debuted in the theaters in 1989 and helped propel Jean-Claude into a megawatt action star. The original Kickboxer film spawned 7 sequels, although Van Damme did not appear as his character Kurt Sloan in many of the official sequels, only co-starring in 3 of them. The new series will be produced by Todd Garner of Mortal Kombat fame. Of course, Todd Garner.
Yeah, well,
with production Garner. Hopefully starting on Operation Kickboxer sometime in 2023. It will be interesting to see if Jean-Claude appears in this new adaptation or not. The show is confirmed to be keeping in line with the martial arts theme, but incorporating espionage into the mix, where viewers will discover Kurt Sloan's brother has been cemented into a global conspiracy. Jean-Claude's last big acting job was a voice actor in the animated movie Minions, The Rise of Gru.
Hey.
Gru, what is your thought on Kickboxer as a potential TV series?
Well, first of all, I mean, we weren't interested. Did you see any Kickboxer after the first one? I didn't.
I have seen bits of clips, but no, I've not watched another
one straight through. So, I don't know why people would be interested in a TV series. However, if you're going to connect it back to, like, the Sloan brothers.
Yeah.
That was an interesting dynamic in Kickboxer. Why are you laughing?
I'm just picturing the two brothers on the gondola.
Yeah.
Like, Jean-Claude's wearing a shirt, like, he almost has breasts, and the other guy's wearing, like that real tight shirt, real tight shorts.
Yeah.
They looked like brothers way too comfortable, sitting way too close to each other.
If they and don't laugh, but if they take a Cobra Kai attitude towards it, meaning they know what it is and what it isn't, and they take it seriously but not too seriously, there's a shot. But if they're trying to make us take this whole thing completely like, yes, this is 100% reality, it's not going to work.
Is this a dearth of new ideas in Hollywood, or a fondness of 80s nostalgia, or a bit of both?
I think both, and there's always been that. I mean, think of some of the biggest hits of that I mean are based on stuff that came before. Batman, okay? Batman has been around for 100 years. All the Marvel stuff that these people didn't invent that. Stan Lee invented that decades ago. So everything comes from somewhere. Ideas are always recycled. So there's absolutely nothing wrong with giving an old idea a new spin. So I'm all for it. There's no reason. I mean, yes, new ideas are great, but the old ideas, some just never get old. And, certain stories will never get old. The Rocky story will never get old. That kind of movie. Keep giving it a shot, because every now and then you get a real winner. So why not?
Okay. All right. Why not? Yeah. Okay.
I mean, is Van Damme involved in this thing?
I don't. The article says that it'll be interesting to see if he is.
Well, if he is, that's at least a ticket into the door for me. Okay. If he's not, then I don't see why I'd be interested. We'll see.
I feel like if it's not Jean-Claude, it's Scott Adkins.
Or, who's the guy? There's a guy that like takes everybody's place. There's a hit movie and then they do a direct-to-video sequel.
Yeah, like the generic,
the main star doesn't do it. So he like took, like there was a sequel to like Black Hawk Down or something, and the original guy wasn't in it, so it was this guy. And he did it for something else. Maybe it was Slapshot or something. No, that was Stephen Baldwin. When you recast them, it's like saying, all right, this movie's going to suck. You know what I mean?
Yes. Gru, courtesy of TheGuardian.com, are you aware that Sly Stallone's First Blood is now 40 years old?
I was aware of that because I saw a couple of stories about it. Yeah, 40 years old. Came out in 1982, I believe. That would be 40.
Well, I have a long – I tried to clip it, but it's way too long. But I'll just read you a final stanza on this author's take from TheGuardian.com and let you wax poetic on First Blood. As it was an early volley into the 80s action arms race, First Blood set a standard that many films followed, but only a handful were able to match. The gorgeous natural backdrop, with British Columbia serving as a majestically overcast Washington, has enough wilderness for Rambo to reacquaint himself with jungle warfare. The essential point of First Blood, after violence for its own rousing sake, of course, is that Rambo may be back in America, but this place doesn't feel like home. He's a drifter in more than the literal sense. The film does build up to a famous "nothing is over" monologue, where Rambo's anguish comes tumbling out as he becomes the mouthpiece for Vietnam veterans who felt disrespected and forgotten at home. First Blood spoke to a lingering national aggrievement about Vietnam while offering a satisfying bloody catharsis. It remains a superior piece of action craft, where one man fighting an entire town was an old Western trope that Stallone slyly updated with high-capacity magazines and gas station explosions. The formula still worked, grew 40 years later. How do you feel about First Blood?
I love it just as much. That's one of those that I can watch at any point. It really is a great, 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 great movie. It's in my top 10 of all time. That's on one of the podcasts we've done. I think we can go look that up. But I will always love First Blood as exactly what you said, like an entry into like the 80s action, almost anti-hero kind of realm. But I do love what it gave birth to. But in and of itself, it really does tell an interesting story. It's really, outside of Rocky, I would say it's Stallone's best single performance, in my opinion. As in,
really?
In the first Rambo, yeah, I think he's really, really, really good. Dennehy is just, I mean, just as always. And it's just really, it's filled with a lot of excitement and action, and I like how they were not afraid to make him into kind of the villain, even though he wasn't. You rooted for him to see Sylvester Stallone, the 80s hero, walking out and ending the movie with him in handcuffs, going to jail. That was a, that's kind of ballsy, at that time. It's an absolute classic, always will be.
Was there not a different ending filmed as well?
Yes, cause the book ended with, I've read the book. The book ended with, I believe, Troutman, Richard Crenna's character, killing Rambo. But killing him not because Rambo asked him to, but because he had to be put down. I think in the movie, or they shot an ending where I think Rambo either forces Troutman to kill him or grabs Troutman's gun and shoots himself. Either way, there is an ending out there where Rambo is killed. But it might have worked for the movie, but obviously I'm glad they didn't do that.
From what I understand, that was an audible call by Stallone, who suggested the different ending, which, according to the author, I did see, felt it did work much better. The test audiences seemed to like that ending better.
Yeah, I did read that too. You know, it's interesting. I mean, look, because of the franchise, for the movie, I think either way it would have worked. I think.
So, you know, I guess you agreed as well with the author's sort of take that this was an early volley into the 80s, you know, sort of action thing. But what I always liked about First Blood was, again, there's a smallness to it. And I think these preceding movies, whether it was Sly or Arnold, man, it just, some of it just got way too ridiculous and over the top.
You're absolutely right. In fact, that's what I like about this one, as opposed to some of the other Rambo movies. Like, to me, Rambo 2 and 3 are too big. I think the fourth Rambo kind of brings back what you're talking about. It feels small. The fourth Rambo has that first movie's feel about like almost claustrophobic. So I know exactly what you're talking about. So yeah, I agree with what the, with most of what the author said. Yeah.
All right. Courtesy of EssentiallySports.com, grew Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sly Stallone met in 1977 at that year's Golden Globe Awards. However, they got off to the wrong foot after Arnold won his award. From that moment, an iconic Hollywood rivalry was born that would continue for the next decade, as each star became more popular with every subsequent movie. However, in the following decades, both stars put their rivalry to rest and even became good friends. They've even starred in multiple projects together. Recently, Arnold opened up on why the pair has set aside their iconic rivalry. In Arnold Schwarzenegger's recent interview, Arnie revealed that he had invited Sylvester Stallone to his office. The Terminator actor revealed Sly had never seen his office and wrote, "I sprung a pumpkin carving on him at the last minute." And soon the pair was carving pumpkins like little kids. Arnold also wrote, "30 years ago, you would have never caught us dead doing this. Our egos wouldn't allow it." In the 80s, Arnold and Stallone were two of the biggest action stars in Hollywood. The pair were constantly trying to best each other with every box office metric. However, Arnold now is 76, grew, and Rambo is 75. "None of that matters," Arnold wrote. "We became friends instead of rooting against each other all the time, and now we actually cheer for each other." They have learned that both stars could coexist and make great movies without stepping on each other's toes. It took Sly and I a few decades to figure out we could both succeed and be friends. Grew a new budding friendship, Sly and the Terminator.
I think that's been going on for years, no?
All right, thank you. Let's move on.
No, but I think there's a comedy somewhere in there. Like, those two are two really funny guys.
Grudge like, Match 2?
No, not something, not like a high concept thing. Something like even a sitcom. Just something where they're, you know, they, even if they played themselves or some exaggerated version of themselves, like an HBO kind of show or something. I don't know. Something, these guys can do something together that does not have to be, because even though Sly has struck out with comedy pretty much, Arnold has not. Arnold has done some successful comedy work. So I really think there's something that can be done there. I think it's time to call it on the action stuff for both of them. And they both have completely winning personalities, and I think they could do something fun together. And I think they should.
Well, I laughed at Oscar there.
So did I.
Why are you going to take my thunder every time?
There's no thunder. I agree with you. Oscar is funny.
I agree.
But he doesn't get any really comedic credibility. Schwarzenegger has Twins. He's got Kindergarten Cop. He's got True Lies. Even had a lot of comedic elements to it. So I think Schwarzenegger has some more comedy cred than Stallone does.
Were you a fan of Moonlighting?
Yes, I was, and still am. And I think I know what you're going to say.
Do you know how Moonlighting kind of tied into Bruce Willis in Die Hard? Do you know what the circumstances were so that he was able to film Die Hard?
Well, he had to, like, take time off from Moonlighting.
Yes, he did.
That's all I know.
Well, let me tell you, Andrew, because inquiring minds want to know.
They do.
Let's see here. When he was offered Die Hard in 1987.
That's a theme song to Moonlight.
He initially believed that he had to turn it down because of his commitment to the show. Things looked bleak for the prospects of him starring in Die Hard. That was until a bit of good luck occurred thanks to his co-star, Sybil Shepherd. Sybil got pregnant.
I knew it, Richard.
They shut down the show for 11 weeks. Thanks to Shepherd's pregnancy, Willis was able to take time to film Die Hard. John McClane certainly has become one of Bruce Willis' best role. Bruce talked about how much he preferred his role in Die Hard to his in Moonlighting. Quote, Die Hard is probably the closest I've come to showing what is in my heart on the screen. David Addison is a character I played on Moonlighting. In Die Hard, even though I'm acting, a lot of what is in me came through. I really wanted to play a vulnerable guy. We should all thank Sybil Shepherd's now 35-year-old twin children for being born at the right time to allow Die Hard to be made. Gru, Sybil's pregnancy offered up Bruce Willis's perhaps greatest role?
Well, I would, I would agree. Die Hard is of course Bruce Willis's greatest role, but Moonlighting was a great show, and Bruce Willis was great in it. I really enjoyed Moonlighting.
Did Moonlighting take a bit of a turn when they finally had them kiss? Like, I feel like when I was a kid, I watched, and it was, they had really amazing chemistry and sexual tension. And then I think when they finally, like, kissed, I don't have anything concrete, but I remember as a kid, I was like, oh, like, it was like the gig was up. Like, we've reached.
Yeah, I guess, but I don't remember, like.
All right, look, I'm just vamping here.
If you ask me for any storylines about Moonlighting, I couldn't tell you one. I just remember enjoying when I watched it, like, the chemistry was great, like you said. And, it's nothing I ever watched religiously, but I really enjoyed watching. Really, Bruce Willis was incredible in that show. They both were. And I loved, Booger from Revenge of the Nerds. And, Curtis Armstrong. Curtis Armstrong. Yeah, yeah. And the secretary, she was, you know, she was in a couple of things. So, it's, Moonlighting was great. But yeah, I did know that. I did know that her pregnancy did, force that shutdown that enabled him to shoot that. I just completely forgot. So thank God. Cause what would Die Hard have been? Stallone would have been in. Or no, Stallone turned it down, I think, didn't he?
I don't know. We'll ask Ryan.
We need some clarification on that.
We need clarification.
Yeah.
Plus, I was very disappointed in the Billy Joel Big Man on Mulberry Street episode of Moonlighting.
I remember that. I do remember that.
It's like a Busby Berkeley musical. You know what I mean?
I kind of liked it when they did the fourth wall stuff on that show. It was like a novelty. I don't know.
Well, Gru, our final item this week, action star Jew hater Mel Gibson premiered the trailer for his newest movie, On the Line, co-starring Kanye West, Saban Films, and Paramount Pictures. We'll release it in the theaters on digital and on demand on November 4th, 2022. Film stars Mel Gibson, William Moseley, Aaliyah Serrano O'Neill, Paul Spera, and Kevin Dillon. On the Line is summarized by the following. Mel Gibson stars as a provocative and edgy overnight radio host who must play a dangerous game of cat and mouse with a mysterious caller who has kidnapped his family and threatening to kill them and blow up the whole station, all while live on the air. Andrew, let me set it up for your viewing pleasure. La da dee, da 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 dee. All right, here we go, Andrew.
Right.
The trailer from Mel Gibson on the line.
Go for it.
All right, people. Settle in. Relax. Give me a call. This is On the Line.
Are you ready?
I'm always ready.
We're expecting your calls. Talk to Elvis live on air and tell him about all of your issues and problems.
If it isn't the greatest radio host. Okay, we got Gary on the line. What say you, Gary? Gary, you with us?
I'm going to do something really screwed up tonight.
You at home?
No.
Does the home belong to someone you know?
No.
It belongs to somebody not very nice.
And I'm going to take out his whole family.
Gary, what was that?
I'm breaking into the house.
Hey, Gary, stop. Wait, come on. Why hurt his family? I mean, they're innocent. You're better than that, Gary. Tell me calmly. Where exactly are you?
I'm at your house.
Honey.
Tonight, I've gone out of my way to make sure you spend the worst night of your life. See, I created a game, and I think you're going to love it.
This can still end well.
I don't want it to end well.
I don't want to die here.
And if we don't want to die, we got to fight.
That won't be easy. Now I want you to jump. So how about you tell us the truth? We're all listening.
Show yourself, you slippery son of a...
Grew? What do you think?
Well, I saw that coming attraction a few days ago. That looks like a good movie. It's definitely an interesting premise. So I have to ask you a question.
Go ahead.
Now, yes, Mel Gibson is an anti-Semitic
At this point, I'm just being kind of funny. I mean, you know, it happened so long ago. I'm just kind of goofing.
Okay.
But go ahead with your
thought. All right. So,
what's the question?
Am I allowed to see a Mel Gibson movie?
Sure.
I mean, you know, like, because if you ask me, if I hear a Kanye West song, I'm gonna want it off. Does that make me a hypocrite?
I mean, maybe one's more fresh than the other. I'm not gonna get into that. I prefer to stick to the movie. See, the movie is a very silly premise, but it looked like they're playing it for real, playing it seriously, so to speak, and therefore I could be interested in that movie.
Yeah,
you know,
I think it's a premise
we've seen a billion times. You know, killer, you know, got 40 minutes, figure out where they are, you know, little clues, and, you know, so we've seen that premise before, but it did look, I'll admit, the trailer did look silly premise.
They give away a little too much. Like, it would have been interesting to, like, the fact that the guy's in the guy's house, maybe that would have been something worth saving for the, you know, for the movie.
I think that it moves to the radio station, because if you watch the trailer.
No, but I mean, like, they give it away.
Okay.
You know, like, he says, I'm in your house. Like, you and me, we both did the same thing. Like, even though we both knew exactly what was going to happen. But it looks good. And if it's, look, there was, you know, Mel Gibson is mostly, is doing all these, you know, video on demand movies that, some of which are supposed to be bad and some of which are supposed to be good. And one of them I actually watched and it was really good. It was called Fat Man. He plays like an offbeat Santa Claus, like a violent Santa Claus.
Right up his alley.
But look, you know, I mean, I just got to say it. If you do, another Lethal Weapon, I'll be first in line. I'm sorry.
Yeah, come on.
Of course it has. Okay. But that doesn't mean I won't be there. It's just some things to me are timeless. And that's a franchise that to me has always, endeared. I just,
diminished returns.
Maybe.
As a lot do.
Yeah. But I would.
Even more lethal. What do we want? 80-year-old Danny Glover?
Hey, well, he's got to be at least 70, 74, 75 at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
how old's Mel?
Mel's got to be mid-60s, I would say. He's a little bit younger than, like, Stallone and Sly and those guys, but not much.
I did read for On the Line, they did cut 15 minutes, so they attack a synagogue.
Oh, my goodness gracious. Wow. What a time to be alive, isn't it, Evan?
On the Line, too. Even more kosher than before. All right, Gru. I mean, listen, I'll be honest. That wasn't a terrible trailer, for sure. Gru, always want to hear, as we close it out for Halloween tonight, what's one thing you want to recommend? What are you watching this week, Gru?
All right. Well, this week I'm going back in time, which is strange for me, isn't it?
Wow, what a...
I am watching a show that I watched when it first aired in 1995.
Wow.
That only lasted two seasons. It was very ratings challenged, but it was way ahead of its time. It was a law show that followed one case throughout the entire season.
Interesting
now,
premise.
Now
okay.
That is something that would work very well today. A serialized drama, 1 hour drama. That's basically what you see like all these things, like they're not like completely separate stories anymore. Everything is linear. So this was a show from 1995 that was really phenomenal, called Murder One. The first season is the, you know, the gold standard. They tried to save the show in the second season by making it about more, like a few cases, and it just didn't work. It killed what the show was, what was about. I am rewatching that first season, right now. To me, it's like comfort food. I know every twist and turn, but it's just as enjoyable. So Murder One, available on iTunes, I think. It's also, I think, available on, like, if you have a device or if you have like an Apple TV or something and you search for things, like, there are apps out there that have all these movies and shows for free. You just have to watch ads and stuff. Like, there's so much out there. So who knows where this thing could be, but I know it's available on iTunes.
Any big names or any names we might recognize?
In the show, not really. Not really. The second season, an actor named Anthony LaPaglia, became the star of the show. And even though I like that guy a lot, the first guy, the guy he replaced, was phenomenal. The actor's name is Daniel Benzali, but nobody would know who he is. And, I can't think of anybody else. Stanley Tucci was, you know Stanley Tucci?
Of course.
He's the main villain, in that first season. So that's really the only name I can think of from that show. And that was like the first, I think he either won or was nominated for an Emmy for that show. And that was like the first thing like anybody really saw from Stanley Tucci.
All right.
So, yeah. Murder One.
On some app somewhere.
Yes. It's on iTunes. You can buy it, but nobody will.
Very good. Very good, Andrew. I'm going to give you a recommendation.
Oh, Jason Gedrick. Jason Gedrick. You know Jason Gedrick?
Yes.
Remember him?
Yes.
Yeah. So he plays a drug addicted movie star who's on trial for murder. And that's the case. That's the show.
Are we done now? Can I give my recommendation?
Yeah, go ahead. What are you watching?
Thank you, Andrew. Jesus Christ, the banter on the show is. You spoke of Apple TV, and actually this really caught me by surprise. Saturday night with the lady, wanted to watch a movie, Apple TV, Cedar Rapids, 2011, Ed Helms, John C. Reilly, Anne Heche, and probably one of her last big roles. Ed Helms plays the same thing like he does in The Office and all the movies, sort of a lovable noob of a guy who's got, you know, no experience and, you know, he works for an insurance company, loves the company, believes in all the products, and every year they're up for an award, and the top guy, who's supposed to represent them at this insurance convention ends up dying from autoerotic asphyxiation. You know, he's supposed to be a Bible guy, a teetotaler, and, you know, he gets exposed. And so the head of the insurance company tells Ed Helms, I need you to represent us at this convention. We got to win this award. And he ends up rooming with John C. Reilly, who plays it. It's a complete out of control, crazy drunk, who yet also has a sense of ethics. And Anne Heche plays another agent from a rival company, and, you know, there's a hooker in front of the hotel that, you know, tries to, you know, score clients, and mirth and merriment ensue. And I just absolutely love the movie.
You
really? you could see every plot twist coming. I didn't care. Everyone plays their role really well, and John C. Reilly is just amazing as this lovable asshole of a guy who, you know, fucks it up, but yet has a lovable sense and a sense of honor when it comes to business, and has like a sense of ethics, but he's just an out of control a-hole. And you know, will the company win, which company will win this award? And, you know, Ed Helms, just really loved it. So fell for that one. 2011 comedy, Ed Helms, I believe it's on Apple TV.
Yeah, I've heard of it. I think I've seen like the picture of it. on the app, but I haven't checked it out. But on your say so, I'm always good for a.
I think you'll have a couple of laughs, fun comedy.
I do sometimes like the Ed Helms character. I don't like it when it's overused. Meaning like they didn't need to, like, not good in Vacation. You know, they didn't need to.
Well, I mean, yeah, he's going to play, you know, a similar, you know, version here. Sigourney Weaver has a great cameo.
Well, it works. It works when it's right. But it's not. It's like you build a character around a movie, not the movie around a character, unless it's, you know, an actual, like, character. But
I hear you, but. I gotta tell you, I had a couple of laughs in that Vacation.
Oh, I did too, but, you know, it's nothing that I would ever, if you think about, like, the original Vacation, and we're getting off on a tangent, but if you think about the original Vacation, I mean, that one lives forever. Every word, every moment, you know, and if you're trying to reinvent the wheel, you're going to suffer by comparison.
Well, of course. I mean,
And they could have. We can do a whole podcast on that one, and I can.
We did.
We did. Did we?
We did a whole podcast on the Vacation series.
Oh, yeah.
It's a high ceiling, and they probably shouldn't have ever be made. I mean.
Oh yeah, and I remember. You loved the what did they call her? Christine Applegate, when she, what did they call her? What was her nickname when she was?
I forget, but you know,
I remember you really liked that. And to me,
my whole thing was this. If you have an hour and a half and you want to just laugh at a stupid movie, you could do a lot worse than the Vacation movie.
Yes.
That was my whole premise.
I did
have some unexpected laughs. And I caught myself really hysterically laughing a couple of times. But yes, it's not a good movie.
I'll agree with that. But if you're going to remake or reboot such a beloved movie, I would have liked them to try a little harder instead of going the cheap way out. But I do agree with you. So, but anyway, yeah, we've already done that. So
yes, we did. Grew in 1 month's time. Our next Van Dammit podcast, we will have.
Hey, wait a second. Hold on. I just lost your sound.
Oh, really? Okay.
There you are.
I apologize.
Yeah.
In 1 month's time.
There you go.
On our next Van Dammit podcast, we will have Nowhere to Run, as Gru and I will take a nothing worthwhile look at Jean-Claude in 1993's Nowhere to Run. You know, the typical escaped convict helping a widow keep her farmland against ruthless dirtbag contractor movie. In 1 month's time, Nowhere to Run. When the law can't protect the innocent, the only hero that's left is an outlaw. I have not seen this. I have nothing to say about this. I'll throw it to you, my friend.
I have. I've seen this one.
Oh, please. Come on. Don't give a blank affect stare.
There are parts of this that you're going to love.
Nowhere to run to, baby.
I don't know what you're going to think of the whole movie, but there are some parts that you're really going to enjoy and rewind.
Well, good. I think our next Nothing Worthwhile. Very good. Our next Nothing Worthwhile podcast, I think we're going to tentatively, we'll figure it out. We'll need to hash it out pretty soon because I got to do research, but it looks like we'll, in some form or fashion, review The Boss Sit Down with the Wig. It takes a big name to get a notorious germaphobe Howard Stern out of his bunker, but Bruce Springsteen did it. Their big sit down took place this morning. Is Howard Stern really the king of all interviewers? Are we going to learn something new about The Boss? It's the Stern Springsteen sit down, and it's on Nothing Worthwhile next week. Gru, please don't give us too much, but give us a little tease. Howard Stern scores his biggest get that he ever wanted. Stern Springsteen.
Well, definitely, I'm looking forward to a lot of things about that because, first of all, I'm looking forward to hearing it because I've only heard bits and pieces of it.
Well, that's good then. Good.
Yeah, because I'm looking forward for the podcast purpose. Looking forward to A, hearing the whole thing from start to finish. I hear it's about 2.5 hours, which is a long interview.
Yeah.
I want to see some, visuals. I know that we'll probably get some YouTube clips. I want to see what Howard, looks like in the studio and like all that. Do you know if they were all in the studio?
I don't, but if I'm a betting man, I think Robin was probably still ISD line, but I don't know. I don't know. That's a great question.
And I just have one question.
Sure.
Did Howard let Gary on the air?
He did not, and I did hear the wrap-up show. I did hear clips of the wrap-up show that Gary was, like, answering stuff, like, in the back office. Like, he was listening, and, I almost cried here, and, you know, I knew it was, you know, Tunnel of Love over here, and, you know, stuff like that. But I don't believe Gary got on at all. No. Did you really expect Howard to give up any slice of that pie?
I would have hoped.
I don't think that's going to at all touch upon what our podcast next week. I mean, I certainly didn't.
I would have hoped, and maybe – have you heard the whole thing?
I did hear a decent chunk, but no, I did not hear the whole
thing. All right, so we don't know, but I'm sure we will. But, you know, one thing I am hoping to get from it is a sense that – there, you know, that it's not so formal. And I'm a little pessimistic about that. You know, I kind of like, here, I want to walk away from the show saying, I can't wait till Bruce does the show again. And I'm a little pessimistic about that, meaning that, you know, like, will this become a regular stop for him when he does like Neil Young or McCartney, those guys have, or Billy Joel even. They've all been on a few times. Will Bruce be one of those? I hope they have that kind of chemistry. I honestly, in the couple of snippets that I've heard, I did not hear it, but that doesn't mean that it's not there because I've only heard tiny little doses. So definitely looking forward to hearing it, seeing it, and talking about it with you.
All right. Same here. It's certainly an interesting topic. That's it for this special episode of Van Dammit. Andrew and I bid you a fond adieu as we say, no retreat!
And no surrender.
Knock su cow, everybody. Quack, quack.
Everybody was kung fu.